This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in today. Well, picture this. A very early Thanksgiving morning in rural Kentucky. Washington Post journalist Walt Harrington is the reluctant guest of his father-in-law, Alex Elliott. Walt is about to go on his first rabbit hunt. He is not happy. But all this would change. Alex Elliott and his hunting buddies are good men, and over time, Harrington began to feel a connection with them and the place they call home. Walt Harrington has written a memoir about his experiences in the field with Alex Elliott, his brother Bobby, and friends Carl Martin and Lewis Stockton. The title, The Everlasting Stream, a true story of rabbits, guns, friendship, and family. The book was published in 2002 and is available now in hardcover and in a paperback edition. The book, The Everlasting Stream, has now served as the inspiration for a documentary produced by Kentucky's statewide public television network, KET. The documentary, The Everlasting Stream, has been picked up by PBS. And the documentary will air on our companion station, WILL-TV, tonight at 9 o'clock. For times and stations in other communities, you can visit the PBS website, pbs.org. Walt Harrington joins us this afternoon to talk about what the friendships he's forged and what he's learned from these friendships with these four generous African-American countrymen, Alex Elliott, Bobby Elliott, Lewis Stockton, and Carl Martin. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon. You can join us with questions, comments. The telephone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455. 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Walt Harrington, a former Washington Post staff writer now, he now chairs the Department of Journalism at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. Hi.
Hi, it's nice to be here.
It's great to see you. Great to see you. More than 20 years ago now.
Yes, I was so much younger.
Yeah. Weren't we all? What were your thoughts on that first Thanksgiving morning when you headed out with your father-in-law, Alex, to go hunting?
Well, I married my wife, and we began making annual trips to the farm in Kentucky, where her family was rooted around every Thanksgiving for about a week, actually. And we got down there, and it was like stepping back into what I think of as another century. You know, my wife was basically hustled into another room where she immediately began to cook for 6 days straight. And I was hustled off with the men who were, you know, cleaning their shotguns and preparing to go out for their Thanksgiving hunts, in this case, rabbit hunting season. And my father-in-law very generously gave me a shotgun that was worth about $500. And I had gone hunting with my father as a boy. I lived in rural Illinois till I was about 11. And so if I had stayed there, I would have learned quite naturally to take on this activity, I think. But as it was, we moved to town, and that slipped away, and I had never killed anything with a gun. And yet I didn't want to act like I was some kind of snot from the big city. And so I put on, ill-fitting hunting gear that my father-in-law loaned me, and went out and practiced on some cans, and then headed out into the field with these men. And the first day was rainy and cold, and they spoke in a Kentucky country dialect, so I only understood about every third word. And it was an obligatory event. But at the very end of that morning of hunting, I did actually kill two rabbits. And it was a strange, exhilarating feeling. I learned to clean them. I learned to cook them. And every year we went back and did it again and again. And it was only a matter of years before it was one of the high points of my year to know that I could go there. And much of it was actually coming to know these men who had been born and raised in this small Kentucky town, and with some travels around for the military, had basically spent all their lives together, been friends from the time they were boys, and they are now in their mid-70s, and they are still friends.
Yeah. They're still hunting?
They're still hunting, sure.
Yeah.
Not, they don't go out at 4 in the morning and hunt until 4 in the afternoon anymore. You know, it's like an hour or two, and some of that is sitting on the bed of the truck watching the dogs bark and run around, but it's still very much a part of who they are.
Yeah. And time in the diner, I would imagine, is still important.
Well, the diner and sitting in, one of the men's name is Lewis. He has got this very bizarre garage that is just packed. You'll see, if you have the chance to see the film tonight, you'll see inside Lewis's garage, and it's just got a collection of every piece of junk and tool and grease can you can imagine. And then you'll also see inside my father-in-law Alex's shed where they sit around and eat and talk and drink beer and basically, as my mother-in-law used to say, tell lies.
You asked one of them about that, I think, in the film. You say, well, are all his stories true? And somebody says to you, well, you got to figure that out for yourself.
That's right. Well, you know, it's not that when you're telling literally stories about one another that go back, you know, more than half a century, they become mythic, and the truth of them is in their mythicness.
Yeah. Maybe it was Bobby that I'm thinking of. I've got in my notes here. Somebody said, described him as a good storyteller and a know-it-all. How do they talk about one another?
Well, actually, that's one of the delightful things about the film, which, as you mentioned, is done by Kentucky Public Television. In the film, I ask them each about the other, and they all say the same things about the other. You know, Alex is a perfectionist who's a total pain in the behind if you ever do anything with him, because he insists that it be done to tool and die specifications, even if you're, you know, repairing a fence or building a chicken coop. And Bobby is a know-it-all who, like, reads the newspaper and watches the news and always has to know the price of tobacco before you do. And Lewis, and Lewis is the kind of guy who likes to get two guys arguing and then offer to hold their coat in case they want to fight. And Carl is just a wonderful, wonderful, likable man with this deep, deep, deep bass laugh who always has to get more rabbits than anybody else. Mm. And if you ask each person, well, tell me the thing you most know about Bobby or Carl or Lewis or Alex, they will all essentially say the same thing. And you see that in the film, and it's quite funny, but it's also quite touching.
Yeah. Carl is I was really drawn to him for some reason. He's a big guy, gentle bear of a man is how you describe him. And he's got this deep voice, and he's got they all have wonderful laughs. Describe a little bit more about what they look like and what they sound like. We've talked a little bit about Carl.
Well, Carl, as you said, is a big, burly guy. He's got just thick all over. He's not fat. He's just thick. That's why I say he looks like a bear. And Alex is a handsome, youthful. I say Alex is the only person who can comfortably wear a suit. You see the other guys in suits at church or at a funeral, and they all, you know, are pulling at their collars and very uncomfortable. And Lewis is just a thin little wiry guy. And Bobby used to be a thin little wiry guy, and he's developed a little belly and a little paunch and moves kind of slowly, and he's bald. And they're a real gallery of characters.
And they've been friends for how long?
Well, certainly at 75, they've known each other since they were about 10 anyway. So you're looking at 65 years.
And are there stories that they tell over and over again about past hunting trips or other things that they've done together in their lives?
That, of course, is one of the delightful things about coming to know them. I mean, in many ways, the film is meant to parallel the points and the themes of the movie, and KET did a wonderful job of honoring that and sticking to the themes of the book. Neither book nor movie is really about hunting. It's really about these men who are, of course, working class country men. And my father was a working class man. And I had, of course, moved on and become a journalist and was able to go to college and graduate school and was living, you know, the upwardly mobile, upper middle class urban life, and being forced essentially to go and spend time with these men really did rub a place in me where I remembered sort of the lessons of my father. You know, very simple, direct moral lessons. You know, a man is not judged by what he says. A man is judged by what he does. Man is judged by whether he's there when he's needed. Man gets up and goes to work. You don't complain. If you don't like something, go fix it. There was just a real simple philosophy of life and how people who had very little power and influence in the world actually still made great efforts to control their own lives and to create dignity in a life where society did not grant much dignity. My father, a milkman, you know, Bobby, you know, factory worker, Carl, a factory worker, Lewis, a man who carted chickens cross country in a semi truck, and I really felt like I was going back to a place that made me remember a kind of manhood that I was raised in.
Yeah, I think that we're slow to honor the contributions of folks who are working and who are raising families. You know, you were a big shot reporter at the Washington Post, and you know, interviewing movers and shakers, and you know, that's the view of what success is, right? And really what we need to do is look at our own within the smaller sphere of our lives, the contributions that we make.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, much of it has to do with what does it mean to live a life well. And I think that has to do with a sense of being able to maximize the opportunities that are available to you, being able to live without bitterness, to be able to have joy in your life, and also to be able to take pride in whatever it is that you do because you do it well. And of course, coming from a working class family myself, and that was very much the motto. It's not the job a person does, it's how well they do the job. And I think, you know, today perhaps there is less of that in the air than there was years ago. And I can, you know, I can still remember being told, you know, it doesn't matter if you work in a factory or if you work in a restaurant or if you dig ditches. The point is that you should be the best ditch digger you can be. And I think that that's a coping mechanism. But at the same time, it's true. There is dignity in all you do if you make your greatest efforts to do it well.
Yeah. There's a saying among this group of men, get off the egg.
The egg is it means that on a hunting trip you have not yet shot a rabbit. And so every hunting trip there's somebody who doesn't get a rabbit. And so you are harassed for the whole trip about how you're still on the egg, and you get off the egg when you get a rabbit. And for all the years I've hunted with these men, the constant comment is, well, the guy who doesn't get any game has to clean everybody else's game. And the first time I went hunting with them, I believed it was actually true. And, you know, years later, my son joined us when he was a teenager. And he says that the first time he went out hunting, he thought he was going to have to clean, you know, like all 20 rabbits or something because he hadn't gotten a rabbit. And, of course, what happens is everybody just picks up the rabbits and starts cleaning the rabbits, and nobody ever even goes back to that. But it's talked about incessantly.
Yeah. Get off the egg, though. I like that in terms of it works as a metaphor, you know, for come on.
Yeah.
Let's get with the program, as my father-in-law would say.
Well, it's just, you know, they have, you know, there's the years of language and stories. And again, you know, you talked about stories, and you can sit down with these men and you will hear essentially them tell the same stories again and again. And each time there will be some minor variation. And someplace in the book, I talk about how I've heard all these stories before, but each time I hear them, I hear some little new twist or turn. And I never really know if it's true or if it's an embossment. But it doesn't really matter because, you know, these men, their lives are their stories.
There's a point in the book, The Everlasting Stream, where someone asks you, why do you like to hunt, Walt? And you answered, it's the story within the story of my life.
Right.
What does that mean?
Well, I think it's some of what I just mentioned, which is, you know, I had a life, and going and becoming friends with these men, as I said, reminded me of my roots and where I'd come from. And it made me think about how I think of manhood. And it made me think about how, as I moved from city to city up the ranks of my profession, I talk about how I, you know, had serial male friends. You know, I would be in one city and I'd have some decent friends, and then they'd go someplace and I'd go someplace else, and then you become telephone friends, and slowly you basically
fade away
and lose touch. And even in careers, I mean, I had a couple of very good friends that I made in my years at the Washington Post, but you know, one has to be careful about friendships in a politically dynamic workplace, where today someone might be an ally, the next day you might be their boss or their editor, or they might be your boss or editor, or perhaps they align with someone else in a political dynamic and you align with someone else. And if you have told them or they have told you deep, dark personal secrets, their life takes on a political reality, and I think, you know, many adults know it's very difficult to make really new deep friends as you get older. The time commitment, I know, in terms of myself, you know, I worked at least 50 hours a week. I had to get to work and get back home, and then I had a wife and children I wanted to spend time with, and I really talk about how I just abandoned time with male friends because of where I was in my life. And I think being with these men reminded me that there is real value, as I say in the documentary at one point, you know, friendships like this among men are old and good and primal. And it made me think about that.
How long was it before you began to realize that getting out in the field with these men was changing the way you looked at the world?
I think about a decade, you know, and I've said I'm really never certain if it was pondering the satisfaction I saw in these men's lives, or it was just the fact that I was getting older and more mellow and doing some rethinking on my own. But certainly when the time came for me to consider coming here, the University of Illinois, 11 years ago, and I was thinking, well, do I want to leave Washington, leave that kind of career? Much of what attracted me was the opportunity to live in a place where there would not be so much traffic, where there would be, I think, a more diverse group of people, and where I could pursue interests of mine that were probably not going to be of interest to the Washington Post, more arcane and curious research interests like this book and this film. And if I had stayed there, this book and this film would not have been done. Something else would have been done, but not this. And I looked at at these men, and I thought, you know, these men are greatly, greatly satisfied. And I can remember looking at the map. I was in Washington, and I had been offered a job here in the Department of Journalism, and I looked at the map of the United States, and there was Champaign-Urbana absolutely in the middle of nowhere from my perspective. And I thought, I can remember telling my wife, Karen, you know, are we really going to move to that dot on the map? And we did, and we have never regretted it. It was a great thing to do. It turns out a university town, frankly, is not as different from Washington, D.C. as I thought, because there is, of course, a huge, you know, population of educated, articulate people, very ambitious, and
can be politically dynamic.
And it can be politically dynamic. So it isn't as different as I thought it would be, but it certainly gave me the time to, I think, do more reflective work.
This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Walt Harrington. He's a former Washington Post staff writer. He now chairs the Department of Journalism at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. He's the author of The Everlasting Stream, which is now also a documentary, and it will be shown on PBS. It airs on our companion station, WILL-TV, tonight, Thursday the 15th of November at 9 o'clock. And if you're listening somewhere else outside of the WILL-TV coverage area for the time and station in your community, visit the PBS website, pbs.org. Listeners, I invite you to join us this afternoon with questions, comments. Here are the telephone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Our toll-free number, 800-222-9455. 800-222-WILL. Have you asked these four gentlemen what they think is living life well? What's success for them?
Not in so many words. Yeah. I think, you know, the meaning of their lives is evident in the way they live their life. They aren't reflectively self-conscious about their life. They, as my son says when we're talking in the documentary, he says, these are guys who just aren't afraid to be. And he says it with kind of an amazement. And I think that's part of the wonder about it, in a sense.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about Matt. He's gone out hunting with you guys.
When Matt was a very little kid, you know, I started going hunting, and he talks in the film about how his first memories of life on the farm were sitting by the window, looking out the back window, waiting to see the trucks come back from us having been out on a hunting trip. And how as soon as he saw us come back, and we go out behind the barn to clean the game and, you know, share a few sips from a bottle of whiskey and basically shoot the breeze and lie about, you know, how great a job we'd done that day at hunting, he'd race out there and stand around and watch us. And he tells the story. He said, I don't really remember it, but you and Mom have told it to me so many times that, of course, I remember it. He said, coming back in the house to my wife and in tears and saying, all those guys are talking at once, and I can't understand anything they're saying except the cuss words. And of course, he was about 5 years old, and my wife was like, what's going on out there?
Yeah.
So as he grew up, you know, I got him a BB gun, and we target practiced in Maryland, where we lived, in sort of the suburbs. And then, you know, he learned to target shoot on a .22 rifle, and then... my father-in-law gave him his .410 shotgun, and he learned to shoot on that and went hunting with us 1 year with me, actually. I just took him out by myself because I, of course, wanted him to learn safety. He had a hunting safety course taught by the state of Maryland. And then when he was, I think, about 13, I actually bought him a full-scale shotgun and all the hunting gear. And in Maryland that year, before we went hunting, I took him out skeet shooting, And by the time we got down there, he was a much better shot than I was at age 13. And so he came every year for probably only 3 years, because then, you know, he started having basketball tournaments here at uni, and he didn't want to go down there anymore. But when he got a little older, he's now 25, when he got a little older, 2021, he wanted to start going back again. And he makes every effort every year to get down there and spend at least a couple days hunting with us during Thanksgiving.
Yeah. I marked a short passage, or we did, actually. I suggested it, and then you said, well, how about if we do that? And this is Matt with you. You want to set it up and read it for us?
Sure. It's you know, just a typical day out in the hunting fields, and it is set in the book about a decade into my time with the men. When I now scan the landscape with more than a decade of hunting behind me, I see the collections of details, not washes of color. I've learned, as the men say, to read the land. The language of the land tells me the ground before us is prime rabbit real estate. Its foliage is diverse: goldenrod, ironweed, deer tongue, honeysuckle. In the middle of this rabbit restaurant is an island of tall cedar, cherry, and willow trees that protect rabbits from airborne predators. Beneath the trees are blackberry brambles that protect them from ground predators. The island then rises to the top of a steep hill where a plentitude of sumac saplings will always feed rabbits during long and snowy winters. The dogs enter the thicket at the foot of the island. My son Matt and I take the eastern side of the slope ahead of the dogs, hoping they will drive any rabbits out front. By the time we hike to the top, I'm winded. Matt looks as if he isn't even breathing. My father-in-law, Alex, shoots. "I think I winged him," he says. Matt, who has learned from the master, says, "He was running pretty fast for wounded."
Yeah, that's great. This also brings me to want to talk with you about the landscape,
yeah.
Which is beautiful. It is... My first thought was, it's like beautifully monochromatic, and then here are you guys in your orange outfits, if you forgive my female nomenclature there. But it's, you know, it is lovely. Talk with us about what it looks like, what it smells like, what it sounds like.
Well, it's one of the most beautiful places in the country, I think. You know, unlike central Illinois, which is, of course, an expanse of flat fields filled with corn and soybeans, with almost all the foliage haven't been removed. There are hills and gullies, and in this area, small foothills or foothills and small mountains. And so you have forests, you have fields, you have weed fields that can't be farmed. You have, of course, fields that can be farmed. It's filled with streams and springs all throughout the area, and in the fall, as you say, it feels monochromatic because everything is beginning to turn brown. But I think that's part of what is part of the theme of both the book and the film, is that the more one goes back and takes the time to look carefully, the more you start to see the complexity and the beauty and what seems like a very, very narrow range of possibilities. I mentioned, for instance, that, you know, we'll be walking through fields of goldenrod, and it's fall goldenrod, and so it will be brown, and it will be clicking as you walk through it. But in that little portion of Kentucky, there are 14 species of goldenrod, all of which bloom in different plumes and forms of flowers. When you come back often enough, and you look out at that beautiful wash of color very early in the morning, where there is still frost on the grass, when you stop and you look closely, you realize, actually, depending upon what time you've gotten there, the frost is actually only on the west side of the grass, because the eastern side of the grass, the frost has melted and turned to water. I say that in both the book and the film that when I was a boy, my father, the milkman, was an amateur landscape painter, also an amateur portrait painter. But he once told me that there were two ways to paint a landscape, and one was to stand back and squint and see the foliage and sort of a wash of beautiful colors. And he said the other way was to get down on your hands and knees and examine the flower one petal at a time. And that close shot and that long shot, I talk in the book and the film about how, you know, most of my life, I think, was spent see the world as a wash. I was in a hurry. I was going places. And going back to Kentucky again and again and again began to make me understand the beauty and the complexity in something that seemed very uncomplex. And actually, that is a parallel story about my coming to understand and appreciate these men. Mm-hmm. Understanding a place that seems simple in its complexity, understanding people that seem simple in their complexity, and I would also say, understanding something like hunting that is often understood in very simple either-or terms, and recognizing the remarkable complexity and intricacy of that.
Let's take a call now, a listener wanting to talk with us in Urbana. Line one, hi.
Hi, I've never hunt rabbits, but I had a friend who grew up in the South who assured me that one never hunts for rabbits until the frost, because then they'd be less prone to, you'd be less prone to pick up diseases from them. So I wanted to ask you if that was true. Then the second, but I want to make a comment, and that is that it's not flat here, it's subtle.
Yeah.
And I think that it's true of any place. If you pay attention to the details, the journey is much more interesting. Can't always pay attention to the details. But when we first moved here, I didn't understand the complexity of the place, but we have come to love it. And it's driving out to a cross country meet if your kid is in cross country and various kinds of weather and so forth and different seasons, you begin to appreciate the details if you take the time and make the effort. So back to the rabbit question.
Well, actually, I'd like to talk to your second comment first. I think that's exactly the point, which is stopping and looking and listening and paying attention. Clearly, you've seen Larry Canfor's pictures of central Illinois, and they capture and evoke exactly what you're talking about. And, of course, the other side of it is some of what it is one's used to. I have a friend who grew up in rural Illinois not far from here, and he has been long gone, but his grandmother stayed in his hometown, and she was in her 90s, if I remember correctly, when he came to visit her one time, and it was the middle of winter, and as you know, everything was sort of brown to black out in the fields, and he was taking her somewhere, and they had something of a long drive, and he said he was driving through what he considered to be these absolutely boring, repetitious fields, and in the back, his grandmother kept saying, "Isn't it beautiful? Isn't it just so beautiful?" And that's, of course, partially what this is about. As far as hunting before or after frost, I've actually never heard that. Rabbit fever is a marginal kind of concern. There are a number of rabbit fever cases in the United States every year. They can decimate a rabbit population very quickly. But that's never been a warning in that part of the country in the years that I've been hunting there. So that's actually new to me.
Expecting to hunt rabbits, but if I ever needed to, useful to know.
Thank you.
Thanks for the call.
And I'd like to learn how to make a rabbit snare.
Oh, or how about a rabbit stew?
No, I'm talking about catching them with, I don't have a gun. But
oh, a snare. And, you can probably, if you live in Urbana, there are rabbits everywhere. I'm not sure if it's legal to trap rabbits with a snare in your backyard.
I don't know either, but at least it's not dangerous to your neighbors. You can't use a gun in your backyard.
No. Maybe we'll get a phone call from the animal control people and they
can tell us.
Thanks. Thank you.
You're welcome. Thanks for the call this afternoon. We've a number of minutes left here, about 8-10 minutes left in this portion of the program. If you'd like to join us with a question, a comment, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Well, how did your thinking about, you know, thinking about the morality of hunting, how did that evolve for you?
Well, as I said, because I grew up in the country and my father hunted, I would, as boys often do, be assigned to carry the game out in, and I write in The Everlasting Stream about remembering holding out, you know, bloody rabbits and pheasants from my side as I walked carrying the game when my father would hunt. So it wasn't like I thought that this was an evil or a cruel sport. And frankly, I eat meat. And I, you know, I've always admired and people who decide that they, as a moral commitment, are not going to eat meat, because it's a very difficult road in our culture to do that. But, you know, there are literally hundreds of millions of animals slaughtered every year and eaten. And as I began to think about this, because even when I did intellectually believe that, when I went hunting, I didn't feel good when I shot something. It was not a good feeling. I always felt a sense of guilt, and I did that. And I would, you know, stand there, and I would see blood seeping into the fur and pooling on the side of a rabbit. And I always had a moment where I wondered whether this was right. And you know, as I went along, you know, I came to think about it differently. The first rabbit dinner I ever served to some neighbors, the first time we went hunting, there was a woman at the dinner, and she said, "I can't believe you killed these little bunnies." And I didn't say anything. I mean, she meant it as humor, I suppose, or biting humor, perhaps. But years later, after all the years of hunting, and I came to realize that I think the answer to that, for that comment, should have been, "I can't believe you're eating these bunnies without having killed one." And the sense of responsibility that comes from taking another life for the purpose of sustaining life is I think a profoundly important connection to make. And there's a point in the book where I'm talking about this, and I say that one time I was eating a rabbit meal, and I was by myself actually eating some leftovers. And while I was eating it, I started to think, I wonder which rabbit this is. Is this the rabbit that my son shot at the fence rail and we all clapped because it was such a good shot? Is this the rabbit that Alex swore he would not clean because he hadn't shot it, but then he just picked it up and cleaned it anyway? Is this the rabbit that I shot that morning when we were out at the lake? And I say, I've never had that thought about a turkey or a piece of roast beef. And I think that there's meaning to that. I think there's a real connection to, you know, I hate to sound corny, but there is a kind of circle of life dimension to this, and hunting did make me think about that more.
What was it like making the film?
The film was different because you know, I knew how to write a book. I knew how to report. I knew how to collect information. I'd been doing in-depth magazine work and book length work for some time. And when KET called me and said, you know, "We love this book and we'd like to turn it into a film," I didn't know exactly what that was going to entail. But as I said, they wanted to stick very closely to the parallel stories of a kind of a personal memoir of mine, along with the stories of the men themselves and how they meshed together. And so, you know, it was a matter of, for the first time, going out there with, you know, eight people holding cameras and sound booms and still cameras and clipboards and doing what we normally did, which was go hunting and sit around and shoot the bull. And I saw a quote just today. This paper in Cincinnati did a review of the film, and they're quoting the co-director and co-producer, Timothy Bischoff, and he said it was really a testament to how comfortable these men are that when the cameras and the lights and the sound booms came on, they didn't change at all. They were exactly the same people they always were.
Yeah.
And I think you'll see that if you have the chance to see the film.
Yeah. They're men who are at home with themselves, I would say.
Yes.
Let's take another call. A listener in Mahomet, line one. Hi.
Hello, I was just listening to you talk about the rabbit fever and all that, and I just thought people need to get closer to their food. I mean, people need to know that just because their hamburger comes from a grocery store doesn't mean that this animal did not sacrifice its life for them to have a hamburger. And I think it's good if people get the experience of going out to hunt. That's all I have to say. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks.
Well, I completely agree with you. I mean, the first time I was introduced to this was many, many, many years ago when someone told me that they had taken a group of children from their city classroom on a field trip to the farm and learned that the children were amazed that milk did not come from the supermarket.
Hmm.
And, you know, that's a little frightening.
Let's take one more call here. Line two, good afternoon.
Hello?
Hi.
Hi, this wanted to call. I am vegan, and I agree with author there that there really isn't any difference. I would go so far to say, there really isn't any difference between eating rabbit and eating dog or cat or people, for that matter.
Okay. I know that perspective, and like I said, that's a fine perspective to have. It's not one I share, that's all.
Hmm. To wrap up here, I'd like to talk with you a little bit about your wife and daughter, and is there something like the everlasting stream going on at home on the farm with the women?
Well, actually, there is. Like I said, the tradition is that the women go off and start doing all the cooking. And I do think there is perhaps it's generational and perhaps it's country. There is a difference of sort of women hanging out with women more and men hanging out with men more. I don't know if that's, like I said, the fact that these are people sort of born in 1930 as opposed to born in 1950 or 1960, or whether it's simply country tradition, but that definitely is true. And in fact, the wives of these men at one point did complain to me because I didn't have them in the book, and it was they certainly could have been in the book. They mm-hmm. are fascinating and feisty and interesting in their own right. I made the conscious choice that I wanted the book to be defined by the parameters of manhood and, in a sense, wrote out other aspects of these men's lives. You mentioned that they're African-American, and of course I deal with that in the book, but I also came to conclude that it was not race that was the thing that was most interesting to me, and also I felt like the commonality of our experiences as men and as children of working class communities, that those commonalities really were a deep bond that I was personally responding to.
Mm. There we'll leave it. We're out of time. Walt, thanks so much.
Thank you, Celeste. Always a pleasure.
Walt Harrington. He is the author of The Everlasting Stream, A True Story of Rabbits, Guns, Friendship, and Family. The book has now served as the inspiration for a documentary produced by Kentucky Statewide Public Television Network, KET, and it's been picked up by PBS. The Everlasting Stream airs on our companion station, WILL-TV, tonight, the 15th of November, at 9 o'clock for times and stations in other communities. Visit PBS's website. That's pbs.org.